Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Wells Fargo versus the Lake of Torches. Mr. Clegg?
Good morning.
Good morning.
The defendant corporation wants a decision from this court allowing it to keep a $50 million windfall even though the corporation has not been harmed by any illegal act. The position in this court is diametrically opposed to the position the corporation took when it went to sell the bonds in the marketplace. Then the corporation told investors that this was a squeaky clean legal deal, all legal regulatory hurdles had been cleared, and what's more, if there was a problem, they had executed multiple waivers of sovereign immunities, and there could be resolved in a federal court for protection. The procedure below was most unconventional and unusual. Within a 24-hour time span, Judge Crabb, who had indicated she might be inclined to appoint a receiver, recused herself. The matter was assigned to Judge Randa in Milwaukee. And within 24 hours, Judge Randa issued a decision canceled the evidentiary hearing where we were to appear, and issued a decision that the contract that the corporation and its lawyers had drafted was an illegal contract, management contract, and the corporation could keep the money. This perverse procedure compounded a perverse result.
Why didn't the bank go to the regulatory agency, this National Indian Gaming Commission, for approval of the contract? That was a tricky thing dealing with these tribal corporations.
Well, it's clear no one thought that it was a management contract, so no one thought to go to the Tribal Gaming Commission.
But if there's a default and there's a receiver appointed, the management of the casino goes to the lender then, right?
No, if there's a default, all the receiver, there's no necessity that there be a receiver appointed, and all the receiver can get control is the trust assets, which are the revenues pledged to satisfy the debt.
You have to really run the casino to do that, don't you?
No, you don't.
You don't?
At no time would a receiver be running the casino. At all times, the tribe is in control of the casino. All the receiver does is collect the money and make sure it's deposited in the account. And if I could be sarcastic a bit here, we should have said, maybe we should have gone to the SEC when we did this transaction, but we didn't because we didn't see any trouble with their representations, and maybe we should have. There are five avenues at which I believe this should be reversed and sent back to the district court. Number one, on its face, it's not a management contract. Number two, to give effect to the intent of the parties and the severance provision in there, anything that smacks of management should be severed and the contract implemented because it is the primary bargain of the parties is not affected. Number three, the rule of Olson, the panel on which Judge Flom sat on, would require that reversal should take place so that a disproportionate sanction to any wrong did not occur. Number four, there is a bond resolution that is wholly independent of the trust indenture, has none of the contested provisions that are complained about, that provides this waiver of immunity for sovereign jurisdiction. And number five, the procedural irregularities. I'll address any one of those the court's interested in.
I take it that your argument that one might excise any management provision from the agreement is really a fallback position to your antecedent argument. There are, in fact, no management provisions in this agreement. Am I correct?
You bet, Judge Ripple. That is my position. There are no management provisions in this agreement. They are just garden variety terms that are found in a commercial lending document. But it's interesting that you raise the focus on the severance provision. The purpose of contract law is, one, to give effect to the intent of the parties, and two, if you have a contract, you should give meaning to all the terms and provisions in it. Here it's undisputed that the intent of the parties was that there not be a management contract, And there is a severance provision that deals exactly with the situation. So if there's anything that smacks to anyone of some forbidden management, the intent of the parties was that should be removed. And at that point, there is no question that this is not an illegal management contract.
And it's your view that these provisions are fairly commonplace in this sort of financing. Am I correct?
Yes, that is true. These provisions are in a trust indenture. Wells Fargo, the bank, did not make a loan here. What happened was these bonds were sold in the marketplace to investors. The proceeds of the bond sale were placed with Wells Fargo, the trustee, who distributed them to the tribe in accordance with the terms of the indenture. And then the trustee receives from the tribe the revenues that secure repayment of the loan that are distributed in accordance with the provisions we laid out in our brief. This is how business is done.
He said it's commonplace. Is it commonplace in dealing with tribal corporations as opposed to just in the marketplace in general?
Absolutely. We filed on our Rule 59 motion the declaration of William Newby. He was the director of Bank of America for 8 years. He opined that there were 30 transactions of tribal gaming that he was familiar with, and at least 22 of them had terms that were similar to the ones here.
Was that in front of the district court?
It was on the Rule 59.
After
the snap decision that we were shut out of the court, yes. And in fact, you know, had we had that evidentiary hearing with Judge Crabb and had seemed that things were going badly for Wells' side, I would have exercised our rights to withdraw the motion for the receiver and insisted that under Rule 12D, I have an opportunity to respond to this declaration and their opinions that they filed only 24 hours before to get evidence to that effect so that I would not be thrown out of court.
Does the NIGC have any role at all to play in indenture financing like this?
I don't believe so. Recently, they seem to be issuing a lot of letters to that effect, and
to what effect, sir? I'm sorry.
Well, the NIGC, there is no provision under IGRA. Let me step. There's no provision under IGRA. It says that all tribal financing documents have to be presented. The only documents that are presented to the NIGC are management contracts. Management contracts are expressly defined in the statute to be contracts with a contractor to run a casino.
That's by regulation, at least.
And statute.
And by statute as
right.
Well.
The statute, Judge Ripple, is 25 U.S.C. 2710 D9. And the regulation is 25 CFR 502.15. So the key inquiry for a management contract is whether there is a third party running the casino. If there's no third party there, there's no management contract there. This is a loan. Think about this transaction. All the bondholders care about is they get paid back their principal and interest. They get paid that money whether the corporation does well, the business does well, or poorly. And the parties treated this as a loan, course of dealing, for 2 years. And their intent, as stipulated, was that it be a loan and not a management contract. So we see no basis to say that there is a management contract here. Now, again, if there is an issue with the management contract, if severability is not viewed as acceptable here, there is the rule of this court's decision in Olson, which would compel reversal here. In Olson, there was a CFT regulation that said that contracts that aren't in compliance with are null and void. Nevertheless, this court held in that case that they would not apply that sanction because it would be purport a disproportionate penalty to the wrong. Here, the bondholders have fully performed the contract. They've paid their $50 million, and the corporation would get a $50 million windfall. That's a sanction that is disproportionate to the wrong. Like Olson, Wells Fargo would forego the contested provisions here. Like Olson, there is no harm in deleting those contested provisions. Like Olson, compliance with the regulations, if that's what the court finds, would have made it more likely that the corporation would have done the transaction because the alleged contested provisions, they say, are for Wells' benefit.
Mr. Clark, I hear you on the possible remand for consideration of equitable remedies. But isn't it clear that certain capital expenditures couldn't have occurred unless Wells Fargo approved? And
absolutely not.
How about hiring and firing of certain personnel?
Absolutely not. There's no hiring and firing here. Let me talk about operating expenditures when you're running the casino. If you look at the indenture section 501, there is a series of provisions. There's an operating account. And it says in 501 that funds on deposit in the operating reserve may be withdrawn by the corporation by on written certification from the authorized representatives by the fact that the funds are needed for use as operating expenses. There's no discretion in the trustee, nothing. If the corporation, which is controlling the management of the business, wants expenses to run the business, it just applies for them. No one at Wells Fargo or the bondholders tells them who to hire or fire. There is one provision in the contract, one provision that says that they will not remove the chief executive and CEO of the company. There is that provision. That was bargained for at the beginning of the contract. It was bargained for.
I'm not questioning the bargaining or the arm's length. It's just getting back to what my colleagues are concerned about, whether it had to pass through this filter. I appreciate your argument on the equities here and the good faith of performance aspect, but it's just whether we're cabined by some congressional mandate that this is the kind of contract that needed to go to NICG.
I think Judge Flom, you have to start with the words of the statute, and the statute defines a management contractor. A management agreement as an agreement with a contractor for the operation and management.
So is it your view that Congress had in mind only those kinds of contracts where the tribe, any tribe, would in wholesale fashion engage a management firm to run the casino? There would be no hands-on by tribal authorities, so to speak. Is that the province of the management directive?
Absolutely. The court has the distinction we're making very clear. And if you look at the actual regulations about what managers are supposed to do in management contracts, in 25 U.S.C., 531.1, there is a distinction between what a contractor must do and the situation here. The contractor, this third-party management company, has to grant access to the tribe to daily gross receipts, has to provide financial reports, and has to make guaranteed payments to the tribe. That's not this situation. What has to happen here is that the tribe is to pay the bondholders and Wells the principal and interest. Wells is not paying for the rights to run any casino. Wells doesn't have any management percentage operation in this casino. All Wells wants is its principal and interest.
Yeah,
and
but is there, in effect, a default position where management influence comes into play if performance on the bond is not
that's true. But if there were no provisions, none of these contested provisions were there. Any lender who lends $50 million has a tad of influence.
Oh, no question. I don't want to be heard to suggest otherwise. It's just whether we're in a particular legislative zone here that impacts traditional contract analysis, that's all.
I don't see why that would be true. And, in fact, I would argue that IGRA, if you look at the policies of it in 2702, what lays it out, they want to make the tribes commercially self-sufficient, and have strong economics in their government, and the way to do that is to apply the same rules to tribal corporations that run gaming facility that are applied to commercial corporations. The only issue here is whether there's a management contract, and there's no management contract under the definition.
Mr. Clank, if I could invite your attention to the provision that permits the appointment of a management consultant. Who actually appoints the management consultant?
The tribe.
The tribe appoints him?
The corporation.
Cool. The tribal corporation.
Right.
I see. And it's only subject to best efforts requirement to implement this?
That's correct. And at all times, just like in the lender liability cases that we cited, we don't want to be involved in management. At all times, the borrower here could reject the lender's advice and pay the loan.
Now, Section 620 deals with the replacement or removal of key management personnel. How does that work?
That's the provision that I was mentioning to Judge Flom. That provision, at no time is Wells running the business. Those management personnel are already vetted by the NIGC as under the regulations that I cited in there, and there is no issue that they're compromising any NIGC interest. I'd be glad to answer any further questions right now, but I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Reaver?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, there are times in the briefs, and even here today, when it feels like the parties are not even arguing the same case. This is a case about the application of a federal act, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, to a contract between a lender and a wholly owned tribal corporation. Wells Fargo repeatedly relies on commercial contract and lender liability cases, but those cases have no place here. In fact, they see no reason why IGRA even affects contract principles, but that's not the case. Judge Rand's decision, however, was grounded entirely on the Act and the regulations and not on commercial contract law. Judge Randa correctly held that the trust indenture, which was never approved by the Commission, provides for the management of all or part of a gaming operation. Therefore, it is void ab initio. He also found that the trust indenture cannot be severed or reformed. Because it is void ab initio, there is nothing left to sever or reform. He found that the other bond documents incorporate the trust indenture by reference and are inextricably intertwined and therefore must also be void. And finally, because all of the bond documents are void, Judge Randa rightly held that there is no valid waiver of sovereign immunity. There is no subject matter jurisdiction for any claims, whether they arise in tort, contract, or equity.
In reading your brief, in light of Judge Randa's opinion, I thought I kept becoming concerned with, well, under what circumstances was a lender ever going to lend to one of these Indian gaming companies if they could not have provisions like this in their indenture agreements? I mean, it would be, they're fairly commonplace, we're told, with not only in this industry, but in financing generally. Is there any suggestion in the Act that Congress intended to change the game that radically with respect to the financing of these kinds of enterprises?
Your Honor, there is no suggestion in the Act that Congress intended to change the game in terms of tribal financing. But what the Act does say is that if a contract provides for the management of any part of a casino operation, then it falls within the scope of IGRA. And I also think that Your Honor's concerns about whether or not allowing these type of provisions, which Wells Fargo claims are commonplace, I think they go much further than the commonplace provisions, whether those types of things would be allowed.
Has the Commission, in fact, regularly had financing agreements like this submitted to it, and has it rendered decisions in the normal course of its operation?
There have been a number of cases in which the Commission has looked at lending arrangements. Prior to this case, and obviously subsequent to this case, there's been a number of them, including ones for Wells Fargo prior to this case.
One of the things that hit me reading the briefs in this case as well was that there's kind of a 500-pound gorilla not present in the room here, and it's the Commission. I mean, should we ask the Commission for its views? Should the government be in this case? And should we find out from the government whether it, in fact, construes the statute as you and Judge Randa do?
I don't think it's necessary to get the Commission involved in this case in order to make that determination. Precedent has been clear that courts can find that if an agreement is a management contract, that it can be void.
Well, we can, but would it be prudent to? No other court in the United States has so held, am I correct?
Not specifically with regard to a trust indenture.
So we would be really changing the, if we were to rule in your favor, we will really be changing the face of the industry.
I think it will modify it somewhat, but I think also if you look at what has happened since this decision came down, numerous parties have gone to the Commission and specifically asked if their trust indentures.
Well, of course, to have. Your brief mentions that a lot, but it seemed to me, well, if I were a prudent business attorney and I saw this decision out of Eastern District of Wisconsin construing the act this way, yeah, I'd make sure my corners were squared. I wouldn't want the same litigation problem. But what does that tell us about the intent of Congress with respect to this act?
I think it tells us that the intent of Congress was to ensure that Indian tribes are the primary beneficiaries of gaming and to protect Indian tribes from improvident contracts. I think Judge Randa's decision falls squarely within the intent of IGRA. It falls squarely within what courts can and should do when they see a management contract that was not approved by the Commission prior to being executed.
Can you point to any regulation of the Commission which would indicate that it assumes authority over contracts of this nature?
If you look at Section 50215 of the regulations, that speaks directly about management contracts.
Management contracts. But with respect to that, provisions like this in a financing arrangement, have they spoken at all in their regulations to that issue?
I don't believe that the regulations say anything specifically about lending arrangements.
Isn't that odd that the Commission would assume authority over this entire area of financing and not say that is not a whisper of an echo in its own regulations about it?
Your Honor, I don't think it's odd when you think about how the Act and the regulations and the Commission's guidance have evolved over time. What the Commission was set up to do was to approve management contracts. What management contractors tended to do was to find creative ways to avoid the management contract review and approval process, whether they called them consulting agreements instead of management agreements, whether they created numerous contracts and inserted management provisions across those contracts to keep it from all being in one document. I think over time, what parties ask for in contracts has evolved to the extent that the Commission needs to be flexible and needs to be able to look at all types of contracts when making this determination and shouldn't be limited just to contracts with a management contractor. That's far too narrow.
Does the legislative history indicate any congressional intent that the Act cover this kind of financing agreement as opposed to the classical management contract, contractor coming in and running your casino for you?
I don't believe that the legislative history speaks directly to that, but I do know that much of the Commission's guidance that have come out since the Act and the regulations were passed speaks to the types of contracts that they can look at. And if you look at cases and declination letters that have come down from the Commission, those types of agreements have been looked at by courts and the Commission since the passage of the Act and the regulations. So it's certainly...
What has been their read on those kinds of contracts?
Well, if you look at cases like, I believe it's the First American Kickapoo case, there's a loan arrangement that's part of a greater deal which really involved the management of the casino operation. Mm-hmm. And the court in that case found that that agreement was essentially collateral to or directly related to the management contract and would also be held to be void.
So do you view these indenture agreements as some sort of backdoor to taking over the management of a casino?
In some respects, Your Honor, they can be. And I think if you look at this deal in the way that I believe the parties intended, you'll see how it could be. On the one hand, you've got the bondholder saying, I agree to lend you $50 million. On the other hand, you have the corporation saying, in exchange, I promise to allow you to manage the casino operation if I default on the bonds. That provides for management of the casino operation in the event of default. If you look at some of the other provisions in the trust indenture, it's not just management in the event of default. As Your Honors were pointing to, there are also provisions that talk about the retention and hiring and firing of key management personnel. That's not necessarily just in the event of default. So I think if you look at the true intent of the bargain, I give you $50 million, I allow you to manage the casino if I default, it really is a management contract.
May I go back just a moment? You mentioned that the commission in its, I believe, in various utterances had spoken or had passed on financing kinds of agreements. What form did they take? Were they opinion letters or?
They were opinion letters, Your Honor. It's come up in the context of the management contract review letters, the declination letters. There's also been guidance from the commission that speaks about what types of things are appropriate collateral in terms of lending arrangements with tribes. There is an opinion letter that came out, I believe, in January of 1999, where the commission said specifically, gross collateral or gross revenues of a casino operation should not be used as collateral. If you tie up all of the gross revenues without any limitation, that's in effect operating management over the casino. What they did do in that letter is provide some language that parties could use in order to limit that collateral to not run afoul of IGRA. So they said, if you want to use gross revenues as collateral, include this limiting language, exempt out essentially operating expenditures and some other things, and then you can be fine.
Is this document cited in your brief?
It is. I don't have the cite off the top of my head, though.
We'll find it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
What about the claim that this is a huge, what's the balance, $47 million windfall?
Your Honor, I think...
Speaking of gorillas in the room.
And certainly, Your Honor, Wells Fargo has done a good job in trying to make this appear as if it's a huge windfall. And they said up and down that there's no harm to the tribe, there's no harm to the corporation, there's no reason not to just use equity and get this result. I think if you look at the purpose behind the act, and if you look at what really happened here, you'll see that it's really not an enormous windfall. First of all, if Wells Fargo had been successful in this lawsuit, they would have obtained a receiver that would have had control over every dollar that came in the door of the casino operation, and they would have been able to direct how each of those pennies were spent. That is clearly a management function if you look at IGRA and the regulations and the commission's guidance. If you look at the harm to the corporation and the tribe prior to this lawsuit, this bond indenture was truly killing the tribe. Every dollar that came in the door was going to fund these bond payments, and there was literally nothing left over for the tribal government. Their budget went from $18 million in 2007 to $4 million in 2008.
Was that because this Mississippi casino turned out to be a bad idea, or that the general economy tanked, or what? Why did this? I mean, everybody must have thought this was a pretty good deal for everyone when they entered into the agreement.
Right, and I think the assumption was that the Natchez Mississippi casino would be generating revenue that would help in the situation, but that's probably the largest reason why. Your Honor, I want to touch for a moment on something that opposing counsel had mentioned about the Olson case. It's their opinion that the Olson case should govern here, but in reality, that's a commercial contract case. It was a case between a customer and a broker-dealer. It involved an arbitration provision and some technical defects in an arbitration clause. It's not a case under the Act. There is no National Arbitration Commission whose job it is to look at these provisions and make sure that they comply with the Act. Again, this wasn't a technical violation. I mean, the bargain here was, if I give you $50 million, you allow me to manage your casino if I default. And also, if you look at the regulation that the Olson case is based upon, the regulation itself doesn't say that non-conforming agreements are null and void. The legislative history does. If you look at when they were passing this legislation, Congress said, what do we do with all of these contracts that are left out there that don't comply with this act? And they said, all pre-existing contracts shall be null and void, essentially giving the parties the chance to fix it now that this new regulation was in place. It's not in the language of the Act itself. And again, if you look at the public policies here, the competing policy of the Federal Arbitration Act and really encouraging and wanting arbitrations to take place versus prohibiting unapproved management of tribal gaming operations, it's clear that the Olson case should not govern.
You don't question that Wells Fargo invoked the equitable jurisdiction of the district court to fashion a possible equitable remedy, do you?
I think they did in the sense that they were seeking the appointment of a receiver. But if you look at the initial complaint, it's a fairly straightforward four-count complaint for breach of contract only under the trust indenture. They didn't move or bring a cause of action for unjust enrichment. They didn't seek any other equitable relief.
Well, they didn't specify. They just said the receiver and any additional relief as the court deems just, right?
True. True, Your Honor.
That's pretty broad prayer. I mean, are you suggesting a district court couldn't refashion this for some equitable relief?
The district court could only refashion this for equitable relief if there was a valid waiver of sovereign immunity that would allow such claims to go forward. If the trust indenture is void as an unapproved management contract, which we firmly believe that it is, there is no valid waiver of sovereign immunity in that document. If you look at the other documents, Judge Randa rightly found that they are all directly related to and inextricably intertwined with the trust indenture, so they can't stand by themselves. The bonds cross-reference the trust indenture in various places. There are cross-default provisions. Everything is pursuant to a trust indenture. The bonds can't stand by themselves. Wells Fargo has raised a number of arguments about the bond resolution. But I think if you look at that document as well, it can't stand on its own. The bond resolution was really providing the authority to waive sovereign immunity in the other documents. It says we are passing this resolution in accordance with and pursuant to a trust indenture. So everything about the bond resolution assumes that this deal is valid, assumes that the trust indenture is not void. There's no reason for it to stand on its own. So without no valid waiver of sovereign immunity, no claims can go forward.
So what you suggest we have here is a lender who overreached and his penalty or its penalty is what is the outcome before us?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what we're suggesting.
That should be the lesson for bond situations in the future if you're dealing with a tribal corporation.
I think it should be, Your Honor. And I think if you look at the intent of the Act and what's really going on here, this is absolutely the right result.
Well, wasn't the intent to look to avoid what corrupt influences? Isn't that the kind of language that Congress had in mind? I mean, was it entities like Wells Fargo that the Congress was concerned about? Or was it concerned about not more nefarious, I don't want to suggest Wells Fargo's under that rubric, but were they looking at an element in our society that would take advantage of the tribal corporation in Congress's paternalistic approach to this area of tribal governance?
I think that's certainly part of it, Your Honor, but I also think the Act speaks to ensuring that Indian tribes are the primary beneficiaries of gaming and that they're the ones that are controlling the tribal operations. So even if it's not a nefarious element, the Act still requires that no third party, and certainly no third party that was not approved by the Commission.
What about a real estate situation? Suppose a lender retains the right for foreclosure on a property that is being used for the casino. That would eliminate management, not only take it over, right?
It would, Your Honor.
So would that be the so a bank that lends several $1 million for the construction and and takes all the guarantees that follow lending that kind of money in a real estate transaction, would that have to pass by the commission?
Actually, Your Honor, it's my understanding that would have to pass by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, because my understanding of 25 U.S.C. Section 81 would be that if you encumber trust land owned by a tribe, then you need to get Bureau of Indian Affairs approval to enter into that kind of contract. So it's
your understanding then that every real estate loan connected with the construction of casinos is run by the commission? I mean, maybe. I really am just asking that because I don't know. It's not a trick inquiry.
I think that's the case, Your Honor. I think if you encumber trust land, and if the casino sits on trust land, then it would fall under 25 U.S.C. 81.
It has to sit on trust land, doesn't it?
I believe it does.
Yeah.
Your Honor, I think it's important to think about what will happen if this case is affirmed. As we've talked about, this appears to be a seemingly harsh result. But this seemingly harsh result is what Congress intended, and it's what they spoke to. A management contract that has not been approved is void, and void means void. It doesn't mean severable. It doesn't mean reformable. It means void. The Act seeks to incentivize parties to go through the management contract review and approval process that has been set up through the Commission. Unless this Act has some teeth, there is a real incentive for parties to run away from that process and enter into whatever contract they want. If there's no dispute, the third-party contractor can engage in whatever management.
Apparently you wanted to do that, too, by inserting all these waivers of sovereign immunity into you agreed to all of it.
In a sense, Your Honor. And really, it's both parties' obligation or opportunity to send a contract to the Commission for review before they sign it, not just the tribe or not just the mudholder. But this result will ensure that the Commission is the one that makes the determination as to what is a management contract and what is not, not parties, not courts after the fact.
Well, did the corporation seek to convince or attempt to negotiate with Wells Fargo to go to the Commission?
Your Honor, the parties engaged in restructuring negotiations before this case was filed, and the management contract issue was raised as a part of those negotiations. It's not in the record as to what particularly happened with that, so I don't really want to speak to things that are not inside the record, but this issue was raised before the purported default and before this litigation. And again, Your Honor, it's important to remember that if this case is affirmed, then it is likely that no lender will make this mistake and that parties will follow the management contract review process. There are mechanisms in place to ensure that this doesn't happen.
What would be so bad if you suggest a parade of horribles if it's affirmed? But what if it's affirmed in part? In other words, that it should have gone to the Commission, which is a view that you obviously advance, and I respect that position. We don't see bad faith on either side of this lawsuit. It's just a negotiation that should or shouldn't have included some other aspects. What bad message would come about if we urge reformation of this kind of contract, not one which in wholesale fashion is trying to, under cover of dark, take over management, but one that was just arguably trying to protect the lender's interest. Would that be such a bad message?
I think it would be a bad message, Your Honor. I think that if this case is sent back and if the contract is required to be reformed, it really incentivizes parties to not do it right the first time and to not go through the management contract review process. The Act is not an act that looks at the intent of the parties. It's really a strict liability act. If you enter into a management contract that's not approved, whether you intended to or not, it's void. So I think there's really no reason to send it back. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Clark.
Thank you very much. I have four quick points. First, I would like to address Judge Ripple's question about if there's any congressional intent. And I'd refer to the Senate report 10-446, page 15 for PL 10-497. It says, management contracts, as used in Section 12 and throughout the bill, the term management contract refers to agreements governing the overall management and operation of an Indian gaming facility by an entity other than the tribe or its employees. The term management contract does not include contracts or agreements for the procurement of particular services, supplies, or materials. Second point I'd like to make is there is no management by Wells Fargo or the bondholders if there is a default here. There is none. There are no provisions like that in the agreement. Now, Judge Evans raised the question about a receiver. You are entitled to receiver not by contract, by what a federal district judge says applying Rule 66. That's the authority for it, and a receiver is an officer of a court. All this agreement says is that the receiver in this agreement collects the revenues so that it secures the payment of the loan. Does not empower Wells to operate that casino. Third, there was a question about some opinion about pledging gross revenues. I'm not sure what they're referring to there, but the only one I know of, I think, is cited in their supplemental appendix, and that was in January 2009. And all that opinion said is, oh, these provisions about management influence, there's no problems with them just so long as they're not exercised and you agree not to exercise them. And that's the precise result that would happen if the contractors were formed pursuant to the severance provision. My last point, and then I'll sit down, is the bond resolution that was formally authorized by the board of directors of the corporation. Formal corporate action says it's a waiver of any dispute, any and all disputes in connection with this transaction. Well, we have a dispute here, and that's we want our money back. And that is not a management contract. It has none of the provisions that they are complaining about in the contested area. And the law is clear that even collateral agreements don't have to be submitted to the commission. Their expert, Kevin Washington, says it, and that's at page 44 of our brief, and the cases uniformly so hold. So I ask you, what's the crime that's occurred here? My client did nothing wrong. What would be a crime is for them to keep the $50 million. Thank you very much, and we ask that this case be reversed and remanded.
Thank you, Mr. Grum. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.